Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. For more than two decades, China has moved from strength to strength. Its economic miracle has lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. Its teeming factories have made it the world's workshop, as the Communist Party has emphasized growth and stability. But recently, China has been hit by a host of challenges. Its main stock indexes have dropped by more than 10% in the past month, amid indications that growth is slowing to its lowest rate in a quarter century. In Taiwan, a pro-independence-leaning party recently won both the presidency and a parliamentary majority, and in the South China Sea, Beijing's assertive claims to islands have put it increasingly at odds with Vietnam, Japan, and the U.S. Meanwhile, in Hong Kong, there is growing discontent with Beijing's efforts to extend its control over the city's politics. All this comes as President Xi Jinping has consolidated power and led an anti-corruption drive that has caused turmoil in the Communist Party. So where does China go from here, and what will it mean for the rest of the world? We'll hear from a group of China experts in just a moment, but first, we're joined from Australia by Qindo Zhu. He's an English language correspondent and commentator for the state-run China Radio International, and is currently a visiting scholar at the University of Melbourne. Qindo, welcome to Global Journalist.
Hi, Jason.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. There's been a lot said about China's economy in recent months. The currency, the yuan, has plummeted to five-year lows. The Shanghai Composite Index has dropped by something like 25% this year. What do you see going on?
Well, there are some symbols, you know. Probably there are also this reality. First of all, I think the double-digit, record-breaking economic growth over the past more than 30 years, I think it's definitely over. We are entering the so-called new normal of slower growth. I mean, that's for sure. So that's something I think a lot of the investors and China observers are getting used to that. And secondly, yes, there are some obviously problems with the Chinese economy, especially the stock market crash last year and also the plunging this year. So there are a lot of problems challenging the Chinese government in terms of the ability to manage the economy, especially the financial market here, as more and more financial reforms are introduced in this country. You would see, I think on one hand, it's destined to have more volatility because it's a financial market. That's its nature. And secondly, I think for the Chinese government, this is something totally new to them. I think there's a learning curve. There's a learning process for them. Simply, they are trying to cope with it. Sometimes, probably, their performance is fine. Sometimes, obviously, it's frustrating to them, too.
Well, as you mentioned, there is something of a new normal in China now where growth expectations are going to be lower. Projections are that China will grow around 7% this year. But a lot of people fear that even those economic numbers actually understate the problem. How are these figures collected? Are people right to be suspicious of China's official economic data?
I think the suspicion is justified on one hand. That is, it is very difficult to collect the authentic figure in terms of economic growth. Remember, this is a country of 1.3 billion people, and also there's a huge difference between the coastal rich area and those poorer inland area. And the Chinese system itself, the political system itself, is structured in a way that is not really beneficial for transparency, for a better data connection for China. So even Chinese leadership is frustrated. Remember Chinese Premier Li Keqiang, for one thing, he's known for Keqiang Index, using his name. When he was the provincial governor of one province in northeastern part of China, he had his own problem with the Chinese GDP numbers. And then he looked at the electricity consumption number. So, electricity consumption, is probably more reliable, the number. So now with the growth of a service industry, probably it's more difficult to get the accurate number. But with that being said, I think overall, you can say the economic growth is not as good as in the past, but at the same time, I would say that.
Well, you mentioned that it's not as good as it has been in the past. Now the economic growth is slowing. Does that present a challenge to the Communist Party's political legitimacy because so much of that has been derived from rapid economic growth?
Well, you are right. I think the thing is, like, the economy itself is a mixed picture. On one hand, you do see a bigger problem, say, overcapacity in the manufacturing sector. On the other hand, you do see strong growth remaining in the service sector. Say the last month of last year, December, basically, the service industry grew like 11%, more than 11%. In the manufacturing sector, some of the industries are suffering a lot, especially from export and investment. So there are both good news and bad news. I mean, that's probably the reality of the Chinese economy. You mentioned about the legitimacy of the Chinese ruling party, CCP, over there. The thing is, like, as long as people, you know, employment situation remains very good, and so people largely content with their salary, largely content with their life, so stability is still there.
Let me ask you as well about the free flow of information, because as China's economy does grow increasingly complex, that does become more and more important, not just from sort of a human rights issue, but from a business perspective. How do you see China's approach to information flow changing?
Oh, as I said, I think, you know, obviously there's a lot to do for the Chinese government toward more transparency, more accountability, and also the free flow of information. Remember, the market economy itself, economic growth will demand a free flow of information. I mean, that's the nature of the market economy. So nobody can stop that. I think, you know, there's from the Chinese public, Chinese media, or Chinese, you know, organization here, there's also expectation of a freer and a freer flow of information. And I think the problem right now is there's a high expectation from the public and demand from the economy, but there is basically, on the government side, they are still, you know, struggling to provide necessary information and to communicate better with the outside world, with its own public, with overseas market. I think that is the problem. Even a senior Chinese official, when he attended the Davos Forum, he basically admitted that, you know, we are not good at communicating with the public, but we are learning to do a good job. And also earlier I said that the Chinese political system is not structured in a way that is conducive to better communication. But the good thing is, like, I think they are learning and they are making progress.
Chen Daozu, thank you so much for joining us on Global Journalist.
My pleasure.
We're talking about China's new challenges on this edition of Global Journalist. Joining us now to continue our discussion from London, Julia Strauss, a professor of Chinese politics at the University of London, and from Washington, D.C., Isaac Stone Fish, the Asia editor of Foreign Policy magazine. Julia Strauss, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you very much.
You study China's Communist Party. How have you seen that party politics have changed since Xi Jinping rose to power in 2012?
Well, before Xi Jinping, there was actually a fair amount of looseness and a fair amount of autonomy for doing things in your own way, in your own region, in your own province, even in your own locality. And largely as a function of what is called party discipline, that in practice tends to mean anti-corruption campaigns, a lot of that old wiggle room, if you will, now is gone. And so as a product of anti-corruption campaigns, and corruption is indeed a huge problem in the Chinese Communist Party and in the People's Republic of China, on the one hand, you've got something that people, broadly speaking, are behind because everyone understands that corruption is a problem. But at another level, you have officials throughout the People's Republic of China suddenly not knowing what they can and cannot do and where their wiggle room is and is not.
Well, let me turn this to Isaac Stone Fish then. Isaac, you just heard Julia Strauss talking about this creating this anti-corruption drive within the Communist Party, creating some uncertainty for officials within the party. How do you see things?
Thanks. I think Julia had a lot of really good points there. I think the biggest thing that we have to watch out for when we look at this anti-corruption campaign is not instability in China as a whole, but instability at the top, instability among the elite, among the Politburo Standing Committee, the 7-member ruling body, the Politburo, and among top generals in and around Beijing. I think what we really don't know is you know, we see Xi Jinping taking a lot of steps to ostensibly consolidate power, but we really don't know how he's viewed by other members of the standing committee. We really don't know what his relationship is with the top generals who run the People's Liberation Army. And I think that unknown is what could be the most dangerous and what bears the most watching.
And Julia Strauss, you heard Chen Daozu talking earlier about his perspective on how China's economic growth was or was not affecting the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party. It didn't sound like he saw it as a major threat. How do you see things?
Well, I mean, the Chinese Communist Party for a long time now has said, we must have X percent growth. Either it's 10% or it's 8%, and it can't fall below 8%, but maybe now it's going to be 7%. These are numbers that aren't transparent. We don't know why the Chinese Communist Party has come up with these particular figures for this particular year. But clearly, for a very long time now, the Chinese Communist Party has staked a lot of its legitimacy on high rates of growth, crudely with the argument that, look how much better you are now than you were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and look how much better your children can expect to be than you are now. This said, it is a bit of a problem when it's commonly, when numbers like we must have 8% growth every year or 7% growth every year to keep our legitimacy, otherwise we're going to have social instability. Whereas, you know, if you look at most other parts of the world, most other parts of the world would be delighted to be having, quote, the problem of only 7% growth. So I wonder if, in some ways, the search to attach a number to growth might actually be sort of constraining and hamstringing the Chinese Communist Party, where perhaps it really doesn't want to be. I don't see the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party being wrapped up in 8% versus 7% growth, because A, as Mr. Xu suggested, we don't really know that these numbers are that accurate, and there's a huge problem with reporting and monitoring these numbers.
Well, in Isaac Stone Fish, there does seem to be a lot of question about the legitimacy of these numbers, but there doesn't seem to be any doubt that the economy is slowing down, and that does pose problems for the Communist Party. What are some other strategies that they use, can use, are using to sort of build political support amidst a slowing economy?
Well, it's a very good question there. If you look at the party's political legitimacy, you can say it rests on a couple of things. One is delivering great economic growth, you know, lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. The other is they're the party that unified China in 49. They're the ones who defeated the Japanese. And they're, you know, for the vast majority of people living in China, they're the only political party that anyone has seen. The final one is, you know, they claim to have made China great again. So if the economic part of it, you know, if they're less able to gin up legitimacy on that angle, we might see more pushing for other angles. You know, we had this massive parade on the 70th anniversary of the surrender of the Japanese during World War II. I think another thing that we could potentially see in the future, if Beijing really feels like legitimacy is really coming into question, we could see more nationalistic policies, not only with regards to the South China Sea, but much more worryingly vis-a-vis Japan. There's a lot of grassroots hatred towards Japanese in China, and policies that are aggressive towards Japan tend to be quite popular. And if the economy does tank, you know, if it's not 6 or 7% growth, but it's actually much lower, you know, we could see a much more aggressive response from Beijing towards Japan.
And Julia Strauss, you heard Isaac Stonefish reference sort of rising nationalism within China. And this conflict in the South China Sea, which seems mystifying, I think, to a lot of outsiders, where China has been literally building islands on top of coral reefs. And there have been all these sort of military standoffs over what are basically just rocks out in the middle of the ocean. What do you see as sort of the rationale? What's China's long-term strategy there in taking what appears to be a very aggressive approach to what shouldn't be an insurmountable problem?
It doesn't indeed appear to be very aggressive. And in truth, we really don't know why the People's Republic of China is taking this stand on building artificial islands and not only building artificial islands and raising flags symbolically, but building what looked to be airstrips in a lot of these places, because certainly in terms of international law, the South China Sea coral reefs, as most of they are indeterminate, shall we say, in many different countries, not only China, lay claim to all or indeed to some of them. And we don't really know why China has decided to push this particular issue at this point in time, but I suspect that it probably has something to do with bureaucratic politics in terms of the People's Liberation Army or perhaps even particular wings in the Navy within the People's Liberation, within this national security apparatus, pushing strongly for this position and bargaining or winning over the support of Xi Jinping and other key figures in the Politburo. We just don't know. Well, but I suspect that bureaucratic politics is what makes sense of it.
Isaac Stonefish, your magazine Foreign Policy published a piece in January talking about China's strategy in the Middle East, calling it sort of a new grand master plan. And it does seem like China has ramped up its diplomacy in the Middle East, in a region it hasn't been very engaged in previously. Tell us, why does it? What is China doing there now? Why do they see it to be in their interest to be doing shuttle diplomacy with Iran or with Saudi Arabia?
I think they did an excellent job over the last 10, 20 years, free riding on the U.S. involvement in the Middle East, U.S. investment in the Middle East. And now I think they're realizing that to protect their own interests, they do have to have a more involved response. One of the biggest issues with the Middle East in China, you know, they say all politics are local. For China, what they're worried about the Middle East is not only oil prices, resource prices, availability of resources, you know, stability of the Saudi government, which is a, you know, big supplier of crude to China, but also issues of domestic terrorism in China. China faces a problem with a minority population it has called the Uyghurs, who live mostly in the northwest region of Xinjiang and who have been responsible for a series of attacks over the last year or two. And China wants to make sure that none of the instability in the Middle East, none of the issues with ISIS are going to reach its reach inside its borders. And so it's being more involved with that because it wants to have a hand in shaping the Middle East and hopefully for Beijing in preventing ISIS or any sort of radical terrorist movements from targeting China or actually successfully hitting China.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week we're talking about China's new economic and foreign policy challenges. I'm joined by Julia Strauss, a professor of Chinese politics at the University of London, Isaac Stonefish, the Asia editor of Foreign Policy magazine. I want to remind all our listeners that if you're interested in more Global Journalist content, you can visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our ongoing series of interviews with journalists in exile around the world and coverage of foreign affairs and press freedom issues. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at GlobalJourn. Julia Strauss, you know, there has been this issue in Hong Kong where a year ago there were these massive protests in the Umbrella Revolution. And then this year there's been this alarm about this disappearance of booksellers in Hong Kong who it sounds like were selling kind of these pulp novels, sort of scandal sheets about Chinese leaders. What do you make of that? Are we on sort of a path towards greater confrontation between Beijing and Hong Kong's population?
Again, I think it's very hard to say. The position of China towards Hong Kong is that Hong Kong is a special administrative region of China with its own particular local set of domestic institutions, and this is guaranteed for a certain period of time. What was promised to Hong Kong was its own legislature that would operate on the basis of some form of democracy. What has happened is that the People's Republic of China and the people within Hong Kong who supported it pretty consistently made sure that this legislature will be packed enough with supporters of the interests of the People's Republic of China so that there isn't going to be the room for popular demonstration through regular channels against what the People's Republic of China defines as its interests. So there's a lot of laws that are a little bit vague there about what citizens of Hong Kong actually count as. And so the People's Republic of China, or at least some security organizations in the People's Republic of China, may very well feel that citizens of Hong Kong, of this special administrative region, are fair game if they get too far out of line. I would not go out on a limb and suggest that this is part of a larger pattern of assertiveness towards Hong Kong. I suspect it's rather like a warning shot to other booksellers and other people in Hong Kong to not step too far out of line. It's more to send a signal to get people to regulate their own behavior.
Well, let me turn that point, which I think is an excellent one, to Isaac Stone Fish, because I imagine that events in Hong Kong are being watched closely in Taiwan, where, as we mentioned in the introduction, there was sort of a landslide victory for a pro-independence-leaning party from Taiwan. Beijing, of course, claims Taiwan as a territory. What do you see as the trajectory now of sort of relations between Taiwan and China?
So the TPP is not necessarily pro-independence. I mean, they really do try to elide that question whenever they can. I mean, they're in favor of the status quo, but with the status quo being a little more comfortable for Taiwan, having its space internationally and being sort of a sovereign state with, you know, really not trying to get into that independence question. But I think the protests in Hong Kong, you know, had a big effect on a lot of people in Taiwan, because the closest model that Beijing has to what Taiwan would be like if it were to return to the mainland's embrace is Hong Kong. And I think the fact that so many people in Hong Kong are really dissatisfied with the way that Beijing handled the protests, and especially with the way that Hong Kong's chief executive handled the protest, that this sent a signal to Taiwanese to say, well, you know, despite the you know, the massive amount of financial support Beijing can provide and the help it would give to the economy, probably more important things than that.
And are there ways, Isaac, that China can effectively sort of meddle or influence Taiwanese politics in the future?
Oh, certainly. And I think, you know, they are very aware of the effects of political largesse and kind of having a sophisticated system of allowing trade, allowing certain kinds of trade, not allowing other kinds of trade. You know, tourism is a big one. You know, the more they push tourism, the more money that Taiwanese tour operators make and the more inclined they would be to support Beijing. I mean, I think one of the issues Beijing has to deal with is how do you not overtly meddle in Taiwanese politics, which angers Taiwanese voters, while at the same time placating Chinese domestic voices that want China to, you know, to take Taiwan, to return Taiwan to the motherland. So, you know, I think we have to remember for this and for whatever Beijing does, its most important audience is always a domestic one. So, you know, first they deal with domestic concerns and then they deal with other issues, you know, whether that be Hong Kong, Taiwan, the United States or anywhere else.
Well, Julia Strauss, let me ask you about another of China's neighbors, and that is North Korea, which has been sort of an unusual ally of China. North Korea did conduct a nuclear test recently. There's talk of a missile launch. What is China's strategy with North Korea? How is that shaping its foreign policy?
Well, I believe that North Korea is sort of a problem child as far as China is concerned. China actually enjoys mostly fairly good relations with not all of the world, but certainly with tensions, but with much of the world. And in many respects, the People's Republic of China is now a global player and more or less a status quo power, not on everything, but on many things. One never really knows what North Korea is or isn't doing or is and isn't planning. It is, to say the least, not very communicative.
And it seems like Beijing has been taken by surprise by some of North Korea's actions recently.
It is absolutely a mistake to see the North Koreans as somehow the puppets of Beijing. They absolutely are not. And indeed, on a number of occasions, it has seemed to be the case that if, insofar as they can, the diplomats in the People's Republic of China have tried to quietly lean on North Korea to stop being quite so provocative. So I think that the concerns of the People's Republic of China with respect to North Korea are two. The first is that they feel that they cannot be publicly seen to be abandoning North Korea for historical and other reasons. But secondly, they also want to keep North Korea from imploding politically, because if they do, there's going to be, if the state does, there's going to be an incredible swarm of refugees that are destitute, that the peoples that are on the border with the People's Republic of China. And so for reasons of self-interest, the People's Republic of China actually wants to see the North Korean situation stabilize, and it wants to see the government become less aggressive and so forth.
And Isaac Stonefish, you worked in China for a number of years. You work with writers in China. We heard Sun Daozu at the top of the show talk a little bit about China's attitude towards free expression there. What do you see in terms of China's tolerance of independent journalism, even by foreign journalists? Is that changing under President Xi?
It is changing under Xi, and it does seem to be tightening the space for free expression. It's very important to make the distinction between the way Beijing treats foreign journalists and Chinese journalists. Foreign journalists, or you know, Chinese journalists with foreign passports to a extent, have much wider latitude to write, report, to interview, to write critical things about the government than domestic Chinese journalists do. You know, there's a very, very big distinction between how the two different types of journalists working in China are treated. But I do think ever since the New York Times in 2012 published an excellent investigation into the wealth of, at that time, a top leader, Wen Jiabao, she and other mandarins in Beijing have been very concerned with reporting that reveals levels of wealth and also potentially corruption among other top leaders. And that, I think, more than reporting about Tibet, Tiananmen, Taiwan, other potentially sensitive issues, that is really the kind of reporting that they most dislike.
So in other words, there may be a little bit more space for discussion of certain issues, but it seems like this issue of corruption in particular has become extremely sensitive.
Not corruption, but high-level corruption among officials who are not disgraced. You know, there's very few things, and maybe nothing in China, which is, you know, which you're not allowed to do outright. There's a lot of different gray areas, and the system moves in sometimes very confusing ways.
That'll do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Many thanks to Sun Daozu, Julia Strauss, and Isaac Stonefish for coming on the program. Global Journalist Executive Producer is Josh Kranzberg. Our lead producer this week is Vera Tan. Travis McMillan of RJI is our studio director, and Pat Akers of KBIA is our audio engineer. Until next week, for all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure.